Welcome to the second hour of Shattering Myth today. This is James and Patty sitting in for Yada. Probably already knows that now. Just letting people know, we're not exactly professionals at radio broadcasting, and neither one of us is actually very, I would say very comfortable in public speaking to begin with. So, we stumble and mumble a bit. That's where that's coming from. You know, what we do have is a love and desire to share Yah's word, which is why we agreed to do this. And kind of the format we've been using, just so you know, is basically just kind of giving you guys a peek into our personal studies that we do sometimes, which is we're reading through the Destock chapter of Yada Yah and just discussing what comes to mind as we go through it and, you know, what we think from the scripture, and we go off on a little tangent here and there to get on it. But that's basically how we do it when we discuss it at home. You know, this comes to mind, so we go on that, and this comes to mind, so we go on that. And yeah, that's just kind of the method we've been using because it makes us feel a little more comfortable with what we're doing here. Yeah, this, we don't usually speak to audiences this size. So before the break, we were talking about fire and the fire of Passover and roasting the lamb and all that. And we discussed several of the different, you know, metaphors of fire, that fire contains here. You know, not only that it makes it healthier by not having the blood and fats it cooked in with the water and the meat, if you were to boil it, and the illumination factor that it would light up the house so you could read the word after the sun had set back in times when there wasn't electricity, the warmth that it creates, the campfire ambiance, and the smoke rising, demonstrating our souls, rising as a result of the sacrifice, and the metaphor for judgment. And before we leave the whole concept of fire, the last thing we want to talk about is that this is the very same fire that will be used to incinerate the remains of the lamb once it has fulfilled its mission and of nurturing the family. And this is important to understand because when Yahusha fulfilled Passover, he fulfilled every aspect of it. He got it perfect. We can't get it perfect. He can. And, every aspect of his sacrifice was perfect. And, every detail that Yah put in for the Passover has a reason. Yah didn't put anything in there that was superfluous. It was all with reason. And, he fulfilled it all with reason and precisely to the detail. And the same, this fire destroying the lamb was part of Yah's instruction. No bit of it is to remain until the next day. So anything that was left that didn't eat was burnt up, including the bones, the fat, and all that. And the same was true with Yahusha's body. After fulfilling Passover, and after his soul was separated to fulfill unleavened bread, the Messiah's body was vaporized in the tomb. One of the most famous artifacts of the Catholic Church is the Shroud of Turin, which there's a good chance it could be real. It's not just a fraud. And it would make sense. What you see in the Shroud of Turin is what would have happened if that body had been vaporized. The reason I bring this up, and it's important, is it debunks one of the fundamental aspects, one of the fundamental parts of the story of Christianity, which is this bodily resurrection, which comes from Paul. Paul spoke of bodies being resurrected. No one else did. And, the thing is, Yahusha, when he rose, his body was not the same body. The body that he had when he walked the earth for 33 years, was destroyed. And, that's why when you look and read the Greek text, no one recognized him. His own mother didn't recognize him. His disciples didn't recognize him until he wanted them to. And, he wasn't just, clouding their minds. He didn't make them not recognize him. His body was not the same. His body had been destroyed, and now, being a being of energy, had summoned up a new energy to form a new body. Now, he could make that body look like anything he wanted. And, he made it, at first, he didn't make it look like his old body. But then when it suited him, he changed it and made it look like his old body. So when Timothy wanted to stick his hands and, finger in the wounds, he summoned the energy to form his body into that of his old body. But when he first met them, he didn't. He summoned it to be a new body so he could make a point. And, it goes back. Yahusha's body was the Passover lamb, and the Passover lamb was to be destroyed. So for it to be the same body rising from the tomb would be a violation of the Torah. It would be, you know, it would not be a fulfillment, complete fulfillment of Yahweh's Passover instruction. So, moving on, we'll move right back into Shemot, Exodus 12, we'll go to verse 9 now. And we are told, you should never consume, you should not ever eat any part of it raw or without due consideration, uncooked or devoid of the proper focus, or boiled, cooking it in water, but instead as a condition, but rather as a requirement, roasting it above a fire. His head and his legs attached and his inner parts close by. Yeah, I love Hebrew words that have multiple meanings, and here we see one of those, and that's na, which, you know, most traditionally gets rendered raw, which in the context makes perfect sense. You know, he's saying not to eat it raw or boiled, but instead cooking it over fire. But when you look at na, it also has the connotation of without due consideration, without proper focus. So, you know, I love words like that because, you know, while the first one is true in the physical sense, you know, as I tell people, almost everything Yah says, if not everything, I've yet to find anything that isn't, but, you know, there may be something. But everything has a physical and a spiritual aspect to it. You know, you take the dietary instruction. You know, there's a physical aspect to Yah telling us not to eat shellfish. And you know, that's that they're very bad for us. They contain lots of toxins, and especially back in the day when they were not prepared properly, could kill you. You know, not to mention you look at how many people have a shellfish allergy. Yeah, you know, so there's that physical aspect, but the, yeah, you know, there's also the spiritual aspect, which is be careful what you consume, i.e. take in and make it a part of yourself, not speaking in a physical sense of food, but in a spiritual sense of doctrine. So, you know, there's that. And one has to do with your physical well-being and the other, your spiritual well-being. You know, if I eat some shrimp when I go out to, you know, a restaurant, as I'm known to do, you can ask Patty, I love shrimp. You know, I try to follow the Torah's instructions better because one is healthier for me and, you know, I mean, Yah knows what he's talking about. But I do have weaknesses and, you know, if I'm at a steakhouse and they got a surfing turf, I kind of like a little surfing turf. But yeah, that doesn't affect my spiritual relationship with Yahweh. Yeah, Yah's not going to be, yeah, Yah's not going to say, you know, oh, you ate shrimp, you're out of the family. You know, that no loving father would do that. But if I were to begin to ingest religious doctrine and religious rubbish, that begins to affect my relationship. Because then I'm rejecting Yahweh, I'm rejecting his teaching, I'm rejecting his way in favor of something else. And at that point, Yah will kick you out of the family. Because you don't want to be there, obviously. You know, Yah's family doesn't have dietary laws that say you have to eat this or you can't, you know, can't live in my home. But he does have a religion in my home policy. So, you know, there's that physical and spiritual aspect. And Nah is the same way here. We have raw, you know, don't eat it raw. Which is true. We should not eat it raw. We're all meat, it's not good for us. But at the same time, you have the spiritual aspect of without due consideration. You know, just going through the motions of Passover, which, you know, really is kind of what you get with a lot of religious views on it. You know, you take the Passover Seder in Jewish homes, you know, there's not a lot of due consideration. They go through the motions. They have their, you know, it's basically a script that they read through. Yeah, okay, now we say this prayer, now take one drink of wine, now we say this prayer, now take a bite of food. And yeah, there's no thought, no consideration in it. And as a result, there's no benefit from it. Yeah, you know, just going through the motions, there's no benefit. You have to consider it. So that's what the dual connotation of God is. There's the physical and then there's the spiritual. You know, it's much the same as we talked about with the circumcision topic. Yeah, you know, being circumcised does not get you into heaven. You know, it's the physical act of doing it without understanding why you did it, just doing it for, you know, unknown reasons is, you know, not a, you know, free ticket to heaven. You know, understanding, you know, why you're doing it, you do have to do it, but you need to know why. And that's the spiritual aspect. So, like I said, I love words like that that convey these dual meanings. And, you know, because it creates the whole, you know, now you have different levels to understand this verse. So, you know, there goes on to talk about, you know, the head, the legs are attached and the inner part close by. You know, while the leg or shank of the lamb is edible, God isn't suggesting that we consume any of the internal organs. The head, heart, and lungs are there to help us visualize the price that the Messiah paid on Golgotha's upright pole. Yahusha's sacrifice alone is sufficient to resolve the issue, which would rob us of our lives. There would be nothing left to do, and thus no sin remains. And moving on to Shemot 12, verse 10. And you shall make certain that nothing remains. Lo yathar. You should consistently assure that there is nothing left over of him prior to mourning. And so the remainder is left and remains of him prior to the approach of mourning, you shall literally and consistently burn up in the fire. Yeah, this, we talked about this a little while ago. On the eve of Passover, Yahusha's body was removed from the pole and placed in a grave. In the morning, his soul descended into Sheol, Hades in the Greek text, to endure the punishment and our punishment in place of separation, and in the place of separation. But there is an essential lesson in this passage which nullifies Christianity's fundamental claim, which are at the same time explain some of the Christian New Testament's most troubling dialogue. You see, Yahusha's body was after having served its purpose as the Passover lamb, ceased to exist. It was incinerated in a burst of energy before the dawning of the next day. The reason the women who approached the empty tomb on Bikurim didn't recognize him with his mother, confusing him for a gardener, was that he did not inhabit the same body. This also explains why the men on the road to Emmaus were confused, as well as the episode in the upper room later that same evening with Thomas. Yahweh is interested in our soul, not our body. A physical presence in heaven would be counterproductive. And more to the point, those who observe Passover, Matzah, and Bikurim become immortal, perfect, and spiritual children of God. We'll continue there after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Well, it's important to recognize that while Yahweh did all of the work required to redeem us, if we want to be rescued, we have to be ready to go. The familial covenant relationship is predicated on walking out of man's realm and walking to God's home. With that in mind, we read in Shemot Exodus 12:11, and this is how, this is the manner in which you should always be nourished by him with the tie fastened around your waist, fully dressed and girded, with your sandals on your feet, and with your staff, walking stick or branch in your hand. You should choose to eat it, being completely nourished by him. You should freely and without reservation decide to consume it quickly and in haste, in a hurry, as if ready for fight. This, and he, is the Passover, according to Yahweh. You were to be ready to go. It's all about action. A relationship with Yahweh is not a passive thing. You know, it's not this Christian notion of faith and belief in a gospel. You know, in Christianity, all that matters is that you believe that that Jesus died for your sins, and you're saved. Now you've got one way to get to heaven. There's no engaging in a relationship. There's no getting to know Yah. There's no getting to know, you really don't even take time to get to know Jesus. And if they did, they'd realize he was Torah observant. But, there's no relationship. There's no effort. There's no work put into it. It's just all about, what do I need to do to get into heaven? That's why you get, Billy Graham's seven spiritual principles. Just have these seven principles. Let's all boil down to the same thing, faith. And you're into heaven. That's what they're interested in, is getting into heaven. It's not about a relationship with Yah. And, relationships are active. They require work. They require time. They require an investment. I always use the term investment and not so much work, because it is an investment. You invest your time to get to know Yah. And the benefit and reward from that is exponentially great. So, you gain so much more by doing it than you'd lose. You lose a little bit of time. You got to sit down and study scripture for a little bit. Discuss Yah's word with someone. And rather than, watching American Idol. So, you don't get that relaxing, mind-numbing, TV, for a couple hours. Instead, you enrich yourself by reading Yah's word. What a horrible thing for him to require, you to actually spend some time with him. Why on earth would you want to do that? You just want to go spend eternity in his home. Why would you want to spend time with him before that? So, did you have something to say?
No, I'm sorry. I was just laughing.
It's kind of funny, though, because you know, Christians don't really want to spend any time getting to know, you know, reading Yah's word, getting to know him, but they're in a rush to go spend eternity in heaven, which is eternity with him. So, you know, why would you not want to spend some time getting to know him first? You know, for all you know, you're going to get there and not like the guy. But, you know, it's because of the carrot and stick of, you know, religion. Religion's all about the carrot and stick. Threat of punishment of hell, you know, reward of heaven. You know, you get some really, you ever talk to people, especially, you know, talk to kids, what their idea of heaven is? Oh, it's got milkshake rivers and, you know, soda pop fountains. Yeah, it's this ideal world of their paradise that they want to see. It's nothing like what Yah describes heaven as. Like I said, you've got to get to know Yah. You should want to. Like I said, you want to know the guy before you go spend eternity with him. Yeah, most Christians, I think, if they got into heaven, would be upset. You know, everything that they love is condemned. Everything that they hate is, you know, championed. Yeah, they would be miserable if they actually got into heaven. It would be hell for them. And it would make heaven hell for the rest of us, because then heaven would be no different than earth. A bunch of religious people doing their own thing. We have that already. None of us are happy with that.
Contradicts the whole idea of family.
What was that? You still there?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I think there's like a delay there for a second.
Yeah, there was a bit of a delay, and I didn't catch the beginning of what you said.
Okay.
Well, maybe you can tell me after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before the break, we were discussing how Yah wants us active and engaged in the relationship with him, not in a passive sense. And Hattie tried to say something, but I wasn't able to hear her, so could you repeat what you said?
I was just saying how it helps with family. Being a part of the family means spending time together and, you know, like having family meals or whatever to reinforce that. So if you don't sit down and spend time and get to know, then of course you don't really understand who the person is that you're trying to have a relationship with.
But yeah, it's kind of like people who have kids and then, you know, basically pawn them off on nannies and, you know, other things, send them off to a boarding school so they see them absolutely as minimal as possible. And, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, how much of a relationship do you really have with them at that point?
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's not what Yah wants. He doesn't want us just, you know, around when we need him. Which is really how a lot of people take it. You know, that I love God when I need him.
Well, and then
I'm part of my life, I talk to him.
There is definitely a distinction between, like, knowing who God is and then being a part of his family.
Well, yeah, you can know him, you can be aware of him, you can even know aspects of him, but that's not the same as participating in being part of his family. You know, I know my neighbor somewhat. You know, we talk from time to time, but I would not consider him family. You know, he's a nice guy. You know, I talk with him every now and then. Talked about a few times, he's helped me out, but, you know, that's not a family relationship. And, you know, I don't know him well enough. Yeah, you know, if I were to, you know, spend more time with him, I would get to know him better, and I'm sure I would find out a lot of things I know that I thought I knew were wrong, and, you know, that's part of a relationship. You know, as it grows, you come to know each other better. And, you know, some people have, you know, I have that relationship with, and some people it's just a casual and passing relationship. And, you know, with Yah, it's the same way. You know, you can know aspects of him, you can know part of him, but I don't mean you're part of his family. You know, you have to choose to engage in that, to continue on that. He tells you a very specific way to become part of his family. You know, you get to know him well enough and you decide that that's what you want to do. He tells you exactly how to do that. Just continuing on, we were talking about the final four words of that, the last statement we read, which was Shemoth 12:11. I'll read it again. It says, "This and he is Passover according to Yahweh." And there are several ways you can, which are accurate, that you can render that. and we'll kind of think of a few of those right now, that you could render it as he is Passover according to Yahweh, which would be true. You could render it he is in accord with Yahweh's Passover, which would be true. This Passover is to the approach, is to approach Yahweh, which would be true and is an accurate way of rendering the Yahweh. It's four simple words. And, yeah, which would be an allusion to the role Yahusha would play in our salvation. Yeah, Yahusha would be the Passover lamb in the doorway to heaven. And thus, the Messiah is the very essence of Passover. This is why, you know, you could render it as he is the Passover. Yahusha would be the Torah observant, would be Torah observant, and therefore, he celebrated and fulfilled Passover in complete accord with Yahweh's instruction. Like I said, we can't keep it perfect. We can celebrate it. We can come to understand it, but we can't keep Passover perfect. Yahusha can. You know, we talked about this early, on the first show. We were talking about this, the idea of a perfect lamb. Well, there's no such thing as a perfect lamb. You know, if you have a flock, there's not going to be a perfect lamb. And, you know, but Yahusha was the perfect lamb. And, you know, while our eye is often caught by the most profoundly important revelation, let's not be callous to the opening stanzas of the verse. Our time on this planet is relatively short and can end within a matter of moments. We need to prepare ourselves so that we are ready to respond to God's invitation. He is not going to call us out forever. Nothing is ever per chance with Yah. So all three items on God's list are significant. Since the last two are fairly obvious, let's begin with that. The Makel staff is symbolic of the Messiah and of shepherding God's flock. This suggests that we ought to follow Yahusha's example and be Torah observant, as was he. Also, by following the Messiah's lead, we will shepherd our heavenly other sheep, nurturing and nourishing them, protecting them, and guiding them. The reference to sandals speaks of Yahweh's request that we engage and walk with him. He wants us up on our feet and ready to go. Now, this is the antithesis of the religious God who wants people bowing down to him. Moreover, the Mikra are comprised of seven steps. Steps we must walk if we want to meet Yah. Being Chagar Matanyam, fully dressed and girded, is especially important because we cannot enter Yah's presence naked. Yeah, this is another one of those ones where, the physical and spiritual aspects are conveyed. Yeah, yes, you should be. Yeah, the physical side of this is saying, in terms of the first Passover, you should be ready to go. They were let out immediately after Passover, pretty much. So they were dressed, they were wearing their sandals, they had their staffs in hand, and were ready to leave as soon as Yah gave the word. But from the spiritual aspect, we need to be clothed, and only those clothed in the set apart spirit's garment of life can exist in God's presence. Yeah, the garment of light, the set apart spirit, garment of light is what obliterates our sin in God's eyes. It's what makes it where we appear blameless. When we're clothed in her light, we are blameless in God's eyes. But more than this, being properly girded is analogous to being properly prepared. This goes back to the whole thing we talked about before with Nah and due consideration, understanding, knowing. In Exodus 1:16, we heard Pharaoh tell those responsible for aiding mothers delivering Hebrew children, that if a son is born, you shall kill him. Yahusha has a long memory and is prone to reciprocation. Love him, and he will love you in return, giving you the gift of life. Reject him, and he will reject you. The consequence is, you will die. Therefore, Yahweh said in Exodus 12:12, so I will choose to pass over. I will actually elect to completely cross over the realm of the crucible, the place of religious and political oppression. During this particular night, I strike every firstborn son in the land of Egypt, including man and even animal. And upon all of the gods of Egypt, I will exact my judgment and render punishment. Passover, like the other six Mikrei, is both symbolic and prophetic. Yahweh would sacrifice his only begotten son as the Passover lamb to save his family. By saying that he is going to judge and punish the gods of Egypt, Yahweh is telling us that there is more to them than celestial identification and graven images. False gods live in the minds of the men who created them and who serve them. And in this And in this institutions, I am stumbling all over my words here. And in the institutions which promote them, both of whom were inspired by Satan. False gods embody a very real spirit, that of darkness, deceit, death, and damnation. There would be consequences for the role Satan and his fellow demons play in promoting them. Yeah, this is one of the things it's important to realize, you know, one of the things in the Torah, or more accurately the Tanakh, that gets the most hatred, I would say, is in the book of Joshua, or Yahusha, where Yahweh instructed them to wipe out these three or four city-states. And, you know, to kill everyone there, every man, woman, and child. And people call it, you know, oh, it's genocidal, it's evil, and, you know, that's just that mean-spirited God of the Old Testament. But, you know, one, Yahweh told us back in Genesis that, you know, there was going to come a time when, in his words, their inequity was full. And, you know, he didn't have them do it in the time of Joseph because their inequity was not yet full. He let them reach the point where they were beyond hope, where there was no saving them. Not one person born into that culture would ever come to know him, would ever leave their religion. And to allow them to live would be to pollute the people he was bringing there, the Yehuda, who he was trying to set up this, test up group, this living example of the benefits of living with him. And so he wanted them to destroy all of them. And the reason was not so much to kill them, but to wipe out their religion so that it would not poison those remains. You know, like you said, you know, religion lives in the minds of those who follow it and the institutions who promote it. And when everyone there followed this false religion, there was no getting rid of the religion without getting rid of the people. And, you know, you go back to, Yah gave them life, it is his to take away. And so, you know, that was the reason that was done. He gave them every chance, you know, much like Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, he waited until there wasn't a single, you know, righteous person in all of Sodom and Gomorrah before he destroyed it. And he did the same with those, you know, in that area of Israel. Before he brought the Jews in, he gave them every chance. Let them get to the point where there was no hope whatsoever for them, and then had them killed. So, yeah, that's how God works. Now, the blood of the perfect Passover lamb serves to identify those who have chosen to identify themselves with Yahweh. Our lives are spared on that account. God said so during the Exodus. In Shemot 12:12-13. I am Yahweh. The blood will exist for you as a sign, as a token, a miraculous signal, an illustration, a nonverbal symbol conveying important information on the homes, household, and families where you, by way of relationship, are at that time. So when I see, when I view and consider the blood, I will choose to actually pass over you on that account, on that basis, and for that reason. In this passage, Chaya, which is used to affirm that the blood would be a sign, was scribed in the call stem, demonstrating that this connection could be interpreted literally, and that the association is genuine, and that the statement is reliable. Conjugated in the perfect, we know that the blood provided a total solution, and that the sign is complete. And in the consecutive form, we discover that God wants us to acknowledge this relationship. You know, the stems and conjugations and forms in Hebrew convey so much importance. We'll talk a little bit about that after the break, before we jump back into Passover. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we jump back into Passover, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the Hebrew grammar. And I know Yada worries sometimes that he gets too into the grammar and that it might turn people off or drive people away, because it is a bit hard to convey vocally and you know, radio being a auditory medium, it can be a little hard to convey some of this. And even in writing, it's a little hard. You read through some of the stuff, and it gets, you know, it builds up. But they are just so important. And personally, I love them. And you know, I've shared before that I've been working on a project of translating all of Genesis. And I'm about 40 chapters in at this point. And it wasn't until about the 23rd, 24th chapter that I really first looked at and started noticing these conjugations. And I kind of was doing a very basic translation. I'd look up the word, you know, and what it means and amplify it and trying to convey that. But then I started noticing that these things, I'm like, well, what does it mean when it says the consecutive? What does it mean when it has the hipple stem or the hopeful stem or the nipple stem? And I'm like, so I started looking it up, and, you know, this was about the same time Yada was writing Introduction to God, and I was helping him edit it, and he was using these, so I started looking at more and more of these, and you realize, you know, how much a word or sentence can change based on which stem is used or which conjugation is used. And, you know, while the translation without it isn't entirely inaccurate, you miss so much of it. And, you know, at this point, I really need to go back and retranslate all everything I did at the beginning, because I missed so much detail with that. It's, you know, it's not that my translations are inaccurate at that point. They're just not complete. And so, yeah, you have to look at these, and you get these, you know, deeper meaning and deeper understanding that are being conveyed. You know, there's a reason Yah chose this stem or that stem. Yeah, there's a reason it's in the perfect or the imperfect. There's a reason to use the imperative form. You know, it's like you take the 10 debar. Not only one of them is written in the imperative form, so it's impossible for them to be 10 commandments. Because, you know, to be a commandment, they would have to be in the imperative. And the only one that is doesn't make sense to be a commandment because of the nature of it. You can't command love and respect. So, yeah, there's so much conveyed by these that you really have to pay attention to them, and it does add a little bit of, not really hindrance, but makes it a little bit harder to understand until you get the hang of it. And what I recommend to people to do is, if you're reading through, like, Introduction to God or Yada Yah, is kind of build yourself a little glossary of these terms. Or if you got Logos and can fire up and use the grammar tools there, you know, you can just kind of create yourself a little cheat sheet. That's what I did. I got a little cheat sheet that says, okay, this is what the hiphol is. This is what the hopeful is. This is what the perfect is. And it really helped me a lot that way, so I recommend that. So let's continue. We were discussing Shemot 12:12 and 13. And we see that Ra'ah, which was described as I see, was written similarly. God wants to see us respond to his instruction. He wants us to benefit from his division. He is not only sincere about this, we can count on him doing everything he has promised. And it should be noted that the same stem, conjugation, and form were ascribed to Pesach, which was translated as I will choose to actually pass over. It is Yahweh's inclination, his desire to be merciful. He finds no pleasure in punishment. Now, there's a perfect example of, you know, I will pass over and I will choose to pass over convey the very, you know, similar concepts, but nuanced differences. And those nuances can change a lot about the meaning of it. La'oth, which was rendered as a sign, is so subtle in its it is usually missed, but law reveals that the oath is for us, not for Yah. It also reveals that the sign on the door enables us to approach God. So Passover is a sign of things to come, or eternal life in the covenant. There is more to Passover than simply sparing a life. The plague of sin, which leads to death and destruction of the soul, is lifted from us. Reading in Shemot, Exodus 12:13, in the plague, Nagah, pandemic disease which strikes people and causes them to stumble, leading to death and destruction, ruin and incineration, shall not exist among you when I strike in the realm of the crucible of Egypt.